Hello, and welcome to the Open Systems Media eCast Dissecting the Internet of Things. I'm Kurt Schwader, your moderator, with today's speakers, Varun Nagaraj from Echelon, John Blevins from LinuxWorks, Andrew Caples from Mentor Graphics, and Dr. Edward DeYoung from RTI. Today's schedule consists of about 50 minutes of presentation material, leaving about 10 minutes at the end of the hour for audience Q&A. Before we begin, I'd like to run down some features of your audience console. First is the Enlarge Slides button. This button will maximize the slides to fill your entire screen. The Download Slides button allows you to download and print the slides if you'd like a hard copy to follow along with. The button labeled Forward to a Friend enables you to send an email to someone that will include a registration link to this eCast so they can also attend. The Ask a Question text box enables you to participate in today's event. You simply type your question into the box and submit it using the Submit button. You can submit questions at any time during the presentations. We encourage you to do so early and often while you're looking at the material in question and it's fresh in your mind. We'll address as many of these as we can during the closing Q&A session. And if you have a question pertaining to the eCast operation itself, you can submit those too. And one of our technicians will be happy to respond to you during the eCast. Our first presenter is Andrew Caples. He's a product marketing manager for the Embedded Software Division of Mentor Graphics. He has over 20 years of experience in startups and Fortune 500 tech companies and has served in a variety of roles, ranging from technical marketing to sales management. He has a BS in electrical and computer engineering from California Polytechnic University and an MBA from the University of San Diego. His current responsibilities include product management for the Nucleus real-time operating system. Andrew, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, and welcome, everybody. So, again, my name is Andrew Caples. I appreciate the introduction and talk about Internet of Things, vision of a smart, intelligent connections. So when I was asked to present, I was invited to present first, and I thought a good place to start would be to define, you know, what the Internet of Things is. If you think about the Internet of Things and talk to different people, you'll get various answers. So whatever the Internet of Things is, it's going to be big. If you think about how we measured devices in the past, mainframes and mini computers, you know, we measured them in terms of millions or tens of millions of units shipped, and then desktops and internet and mobility, you know, we started to measure in hundreds of millions and actually started to encroach on billions of units shipped. Internet of Things is going to dwarf all that. We're going to start talking in tens of billions and more of devices. The building blocks, inexpensive low-power processors, low-cost wireless connectivity, including Bluetooth, which is going to serve as enablers for cloud integration. And, of course, with IPv6, you know, there's going to be what seems to be an endless supply of IP addresses. And all of this is going to need to be assimilated, or all the data is going to need to be assimilated and correlated and displayed in a meaningful way. So you'll see a need for big data analytics. So one way to think about the Internet of Things is as an array of billions of devices all connected, each capable of making decisions on their own or based on higher level decisions. So a collection of sensors, accelerometers, gyros, pressure sensors, compass, temperature, proximity sensors, actuators, you know, all doing distributed computing with wireless communication. It'll be machine-to-machine, machine-to-infrastructure, machine-to-environment. The financial impact will be tremendous. There's reports out there that suggest the impact will be in excess of $14 trillion, which is roughly the size of the annual U.S. GDP or a quarter of the worldwide GDP. So knowing that the Internet of Things is going to be big, what's that mean for us? Well, try to pick something that we can all relate to. And so a refrigerator is a device that fits that category. So certainly the refrigerator will be an Internet of Things. It will be connected via the LAN into an access point for WAN and subsequent cloud integration. All right, so what does that mean? Well, certainly from a personal perspective, I'll be able to, you know, monitor my refrigerator, understand the temperature that it's operating at, the efficiency, the energy use, the cost per month, mundane things like the status of the water filter, There may be some other things that we can expect to see, such as if I'm monitoring my sodium or sugar levels, maybe I'll get some feedback from the refrigerator, or maybe I'll be able to integrate it with my Fitbit to monitor the calories consumed versus the calories burned. In addition to that, right, the refrigerator will be connected to the WAN, and the WAN is going to allow service providers to be able to monitor my refrigerator, to be able to take proactive steps and suggest maintenance repair before a major malfunction, to be able to monitor mean time to failure for components, and should a repair be necessary, be able to schedule based on my calendar that's conducive with my schedule, so I don't have to do anything that's inconvenient to be able to support a service visit. Additionally, we all know that power consumption or the demand for power is outpacing the rate of energy production. You know, the estimates are staggering for what is required over the next 10 years to meet energy demand. It's in the hundreds of billions and approaching $1 trillion. So supply-side solutions may not be the best approach. With Internet of Things, you know, during peak periods of energy demand, that is when the demand is exceeding capacity, today the utility companies don't really have any options other than to charge us more. So for those who choose to participate, there can be a day where the utility companies will send messages to the home to inform consumers that we're in peak periods. That energy production is at a higher price. And as part of that, you know, it'll allow consumers to make informed decisions using protocols that are established, such as Smart Energy Profile and others. The refrigerator could actually act on a demand response from a utility company and go into a sleep or low power mode and send a message back to utility or actually to the consumer to notify them of the change in the status. When we think of Internet of Things, security is going to be a big component of this. The last thing we want is anybody to be able to access our refrigerator, to put it in a low power mode or turn it off without our knowledge or authorization. When it comes to Internet of Things, I also look at it from a personal perspective. My son, who plays soccer, recently suffered an ACL injury. And not going through this before, I listened to the surgeon, and it was clear to me that as the surgeon was talking about the repair, there was no way that joint was ever going to be the same. It was going to be, independent of how good the surgeon was, there was going to be some excess pressure or some uneven wear. And that's not going to manifest for decades. The only tools today that the surgeon has to understand the status of the repair is to ask the patient how they're feeling. I can see as part of Internet of Things where sensors will be placed in the joints to provide a surgeon with real data, meaningful data, over prolonged periods of time so that decisions can be made proactively instead of trying to create or trying to treat chronic issues. When it comes to Internet of Things, integration of devices such that you're going to have to insert devices into a network and remove devices from a network without any need of administrative network functions. So what does that really mean? Well, I guess when you think about the Internet of Things, you know, the Internet of Things is actually a trillion small things. Network microcomputers with sensors and actuators, you know, are about to be embedded in essentially any tangible object or place, ready to observe and control the real world. Imagine tiny web servers and all embedded devices ready to connect to the Internet. So from a perspective of an operating system, that's going to require an operating system that's scalable, that can fit into sensors and devices that are resource constrained. That's going to require support for connectivity, whether it's Bluetooth low energy, Zigbee, 802.11, IPv6 support, and associated middleware for database support, graphics and encryption, and zero configuration networking. So with that, I will, as a prelude of what our vision of the Internet of Things is, I will turn it over to my colleagues.
Great. Thank you very much, Andrew. Our next speaker is Dr. Edwin Young. He is Vice President of Sales at RTI. Dr. DeYoung brings over 20 years of experience in the software industry. He is one of the pioneers in the development of large-scale, real-time, published, subscribed middleware that is now helping to enable the Internet of Things. He previously served as Director of Product Management and Strategy at RTI. Edwin, the floor is yours.
Thank you for the introduction, Kurt. Hello, everybody. In case you're not familiar with RTI, we provide the communications platform for the real-time Internet of Things. And the platform is called RTI Connects DDS. Basically, it provides the communications intelligence for smart distributed applications. And RTI Connects DDS allows devices to seamlessly share information and work together as one integrated system. So when we look back, the Internet revolutionized how people communicated together and how we worked together. And it basically transformed our life in ways that were impossible to imagine. The next wave of the Internet is, however, not about people. It's going to be about intelligent and connected devices. And to interact successfully with the world around us, these devices must work together, and they must work together with speeds and capabilities far beyond what people need today. And at RTI, we believe the Internet of Things will change the world around us more profoundly than today's Internet. So speaking of today's Internet, it connects basically about a billion sites, and that by itself is a huge number. And as Andrew already said, we're quickly adding smartphones and iPads, and with more than 5 billion smartphones out there, most people will soon have access to mobile connectivity. Now, there are also about 50 billion smart devices out there. And it's the IoT's opportunity, but at the same time, also its challenge, to connect all these devices in a meaningful way and to deliver machine-to-machine applications. So where are all these devices? In fact, they are part of everyday life, and you may own many of them. Your car, for example, likely uses more than 100 embedded processors. And in general, we find smart devices in industrial systems, hospitals, in our homes, and in transportation systems, for example. So what is the Internet of Things? Well, let's see what some of the big players say. So Cisco, for example, calls it the Internet of Everything. They say it will be the latest wave of the Internet connecting physical objects to provide better safety, comfort, and efficiency. When we look at IBM, they call it a completely new World Wide Web. They say it's comprised of the messages that digitally empowered devices would send to one another. When we look at GE, at General Electric, their industrial Internet is perhaps the most exciting vision. It directly envisions new applications, and they call it the convergence of machine and intelligent data to create brilliant machines. At RTI, our company slogan is "Your systems working as one," and we believe the IoT will be an entirely new utility, and it will fundamentally change the world around us. Okay, so the first question to ask is maybe, what are the things? But we'll leave that alone for a minute and ask the question, what connects the things? And there are a few scenarios to consider. First, devices must communicate with each other, like the embedded processors in your car that I mentioned earlier, and like your car with roadside systems. Next, the device data must be collected and sent to the server infrastructure. And then that server infrastructure has to share device data for processing, for load balancing in the server farm, and for high availability. And finally, of course, the people will want access to that process data. And at a high level, each of these communication scenarios are covered by different communication protocols.
There is, for example, MQTT, which is a protocol very good at collecting device data and communicating it back to the servers, to the enterprise. Then there's AMQP, which is a message queuing service designed to relay messages between the servers. And then there's XMPP, which is a protocol best for connecting people to the cloud. And in contrast to MQTT, XMPP, and AMQP, the Data Distribution Service, or DDS, targets device-to-device communication directly. So that's the scenario shown at the bottom here of this slide. And DDS's main purpose is to connect devices to other devices. It is a data-centric middleware standard with roots in high-performance defense, industrial, and embedded applications. And DDS can efficiently deliver millions of updates per second to many receivers at the same time. And we'll talk more about DDS in a second. But the observation here is that each of these protocols is widely adopted and serves a particular use case within the Internet of Things. So let me explain a bit more why DDS is a good solution for device-to-device communication. Well, devices demand data very differently than IT infrastructure demands data, or very differently than people demands data, for that matter. First of all, devices are fast, and by fast I mean the response time is measured in microseconds. Devices need to communicate with many other devices in complex ways. So if you look at TCP, for example, its simple point-to-point streams are far too limiting. So instead, DDS offers very fine-grained quality of service control. It offers multicast and configurable reliability, and it supports redundancy for fault tolerance. DDS also offers powerful ways to filter data on content and route data intelligently based on those content filters. And in fact, many high-performance integrated device systems use DDS today. It is the only technology that delivers the flexibility, the reliability, and the speed necessary to build complex real-time applications. And this slide gives you a flavor of the types of applications DDS is used in. They include military systems, wind farms and hospital integration. They also include medical imaging, asset tracking systems, and automated test and safety, for example. And in all these applications, DDS connects the devices together into a working distributed systems at physics speeds. What I want to do next is show you some of these applications in just a tiny bit more detail. And development of DDS was originally driven by the U.S. DoD, and specifically by the U.S. Navy. For example, DDS is used in a new DDG 1000 stealth-guided missile destroyer. You see a picture of that, that destroyer here. And as you can imagine, this is not a small system. DDS is used to connect 1,500 applications and devices on board this ship. And these types of requirements drove DDS to be designed as a highly scalable solution from the ground up. And by the way, for you Star Trek fans out there, DDG 1000 is commanded by Captain James Kirk. I'm not kidding. Here's a recent use case of DDS that's becoming more popular in healthcare. The use case is real-time information sharing between mobile medical devices, for example, in ambulances and data centers and hospitals. As emergency teams treat a patient, they provide information to the data center, which can then be accessed by the clinicians at the hospital. So here we have a situation where time-critical data is going over constrained links and must reliably reach the hospital. In this use case, DDS is used in the ambulance, in the data center, and at the hospital. And this example shows there's overlap between the IoT protocols, because earlier I said that MQTT is a protocol for collecting device data and communicating it to the servers. Though that is true generally, DDS is a better fit here in this specific case because of the constraint links the data must be sent over. Staying with healthcare, last year, Hospital error was the sixth leading preventable cause of death here in the U.S. And now there is a new device interoperability standard called ICE. It stands for Integrated Clinical Environment. And what ICE enables hospitals to do is that in your room, all data from every device you're hooked up to gets collected. So think about an ECG, an oximeter, infusion pump, a ventilator, and many other medical devices. On the collected data, they then run data fusion and control algorithms that react automatically. So for instance, by adjusting your IV drip to compensate for a low heart rate. These same data fusion algorithms also can detect and suppress false alarms. And false alarm fatigue is actually often a cause of error in hospitals. Now, within the ICE standard, DDS makes it possible to collect all the device data in real time and then bring that data together for the data fusion algorithms. An entirely different example, but still in healthcare, is robotic surgery. When operating on a beating heart, for example, real-time coordination between three robots allows the surgeon to perceive a static surface while the heart is beating. So for this to happen, the haptic sensor loop runs at 1 to 3 kilohertz, so that's 1,000 to 3,000 updates per second. And DDS is used to send all those updates in real time and at that rate. Now contrast this 1 to 3 kilohertz update rate with the next application, which is controlling robots from space for extraterrestrial exploration. This is the total opposite of the 1 to 3 kilohertz updates we just talked about. Now we're dealing with long transmission delays over low bandwidth communication links in space. The point is that DDS provides the flexible quality of service parameters to support communication across these very different types of links. And finally, from space, we move to underground. Joe Mining is using DDS to gather information from their mining machines. And this machine that you see here, by the way, is higher than a person. So it's a pretty big machine. What they do is they send the gathered information to the top of the mine for data analysis, and this allows mining companies to maximize utilization of the machines down in the mine, and it allows them to minimize downtime and overall reduce the operating costs of the mine. So we see that the Internet of Things is a big place with many very different things and with room for many different protocols to connect the things. And our advice here at RTI is to choose the protocol for your application carefully and without prejudice of what you know. Thank you for your attention, and back to you, Kurt.
Thank you very much, Edwin. Our next speaker is Varun Nagaraj. He is the Senior Vice President and General Manager, Internet of Things at Echelon Corporation. He has more than 25 years of high-tech product planning and strategy experience. He holds a BSEE from IIT Bombay, a Master's in Computer Engineering from North Carolina State University, and an MBA from Boston University. Varun.
Thank you, Kurt. Good day, everybody. So I'm going to introduce a slightly different term and focus in on a portion or a part of the Internet of Things. You know, the Internet of Things is a lot of things, and, you know, Andrew in his first presentation talked about the refrigerator, and these are the kinds of exciting use cases most people think about today when they think about the Internet of Things. You know, the Fitbit that you wear on your wrist, you know, your ability, your Nest thermostat at home that you're able to connect to over your iPad. That's really what most folks think about when they think about the Internet of Things. I'm here to introduce a phrase called the Industrial Internet of Things. So it's sort of, it's like the granddaddy of the Internet of Things, if you will, or the sort of the boring, but yet I think the most fascinating segment of the Internet of Things. Before it was called the Industrial Internet of Things, it was called control networking, right? And control networking, factory automation, building automation, lighting automation, all of these things have been around for 20, 30, 40 years. And just wanted to take a second to introduce Echelon as a company that has actually been a part of that control networking revolution over the last 25, 30 years. So control networking really encompassed a lot of things except consumer. And it wasn't called the Internet of Things. It was just called control networking. So this is really the heritage that I personally build upon here as we talk today about this particular part of the Internet of Things called the Industrial Internet of Things. Specifically, the Industrial Internet of Things is, in fact, control networking 2.0, right? So control networking is evolving or transitioning from the old-fashioned approach to tying these things together to something new and different. And the something new and different is being heavily influenced by all of these technologies that are also talked about as part of the Internet of Things. Specifically, you can think about taking the old concept of control networking. And the old concept of control networking, by the way, might be within a building. You have an air conditioning system and air control units and fan coil units. You have door sensors. You have occupancy sensors. These technologies have been around for a while, well before it was called the Internet of Things. And buildings work together so that if someone opens up a door, there is an alarm that then potentially lights up all the lights that are relevant to where this person might be going. Or if a smoke detector detects a bunch of smoke, the door locks automatically open just in case there is a fire. These are the types of use cases that have defined control networking for years. Now, add to that some of these newer technologies everybody is talking about. What happens when you actually take IP, the Internet Protocol, and put it into every single device? Imagine every door lock, every sensor, every light bulb, every smoke detector equipped with an IP address. How does that change the world? The old control networking was mostly about wired communications, right? Because people did not use wireless for such, mission-critical uses. But now add a dash of wireless into the old-fashioned control networking, and how does that change? And think about now multiple protocols that have evolved over time in the area of control networking. Device protocols you may never have heard about, like DeviceNet or Profibus or BACnet. These are all a million protocols that have proliferated in the industrial space. Add to that the fact that you can do cloud computing and big data analytics. And what you get as a result is really the concept of the Industrial Internet of Things. Now, we think this Industrial Internet of Things, even though it is not the one that is talked about the most, is really going to be the largest and, frankly, the most interesting part of the Internet of Things. This is where I think the hardest challenges are. This is where I think over time the most satisfying and sort of humanity-advancing applications will be built. Personally instrumenting your body is a great idea. Telling the refrigerator, milk carton telling you it's gone bad, hey, that's kind of cool. But I think the real economic benefits that will accrue to society will come from applications and devices done for the Industrial Internet of Things. So the various charts here basically show you how the Industrial Internet of Things is, in fact, expected to be the largest part of the Internet of Things, much bigger than mobile phones, much bigger than even PC connectivity. And these would be industrial applications, much more so than consumer applications. Another interesting chart at the bottom of your slide is the fact that while everybody is breathless about different forms of wireless, Wi-Fi and Bluetooth and Zigbee and so forth, the fact is in this part of the market, the biggest part of the market, wired communications is still going to be the dominant way in which these devices communicate with each other. So hopefully I've introduced at least two ideas, for your consideration. One, within the Internet of Things, the industrial segment in many ways is the most fascinating segment. And second, in spite of all the talk about wireless, we believe wired actually has a very continued and rich future going forward. And so these aspects of the Industrial Internet of Things make it unique. So for example, in the Industrial Internet of Things, you need to have the ability for devices to work by themselves without human interaction, without an operator telling a device what to do. These communities of devices need to figure out what actions to take based on what is happening within their community. So as you can see, that's quite a different requirement. The requirement for reliability is way higher in this particular segment relative to other segments. In this segment, devices need to coexist with devices that were installed 20 years ago. And that's not a requirement, for example, on the consumer Internet of Things where you throw away your old iPhone 3 as you buy your iPhone 5. So this is basically a completely different kind of environment, right? The industrial Internet of Things, so it's large and it's quite different. Now, just one realistic example of the Internet of Things in the industrial world being different. Think about how things are connected. In the office, for example, if you're connecting computers around, you know, you would connect a computer to an Ethernet switch or you would use Wi-Fi. At home, that's how you basically connect things up. But in an industrial environment, and again, I'm using this just as an example to show you why it is such a different environment, this diagram here sort of describes how things get connected on a factory floor or within a building automation setup or for a lighting control setup or within a hospital where multiple devices might be connected. You have combinations of structured wiring and unstructured wiring. You have combinations of loops and stars and rings and buses and so forth. And these require unique technologies that are appropriate for this kind of connectivity. So just any old technology from the Internet, if you will, doesn't necessarily do it for the industrial Internet of Things. And so here's one particular example. So let's say you were building together an interesting application for industrial automation. So you're going to be building a set of devices, and these devices are what are in the lower part of the chart. You know, these are all in the flashes of blue. So you might have a certain device that is a high-speed device, something that's a low-speed device, a device that is on a low-power radio, a device that might be on an unstructured piece of cabling that is running through the plant. But all of these devices really want to act as a community. You know, they do not need the Internet telling them what to do every single time. And that is a mistake that a lot of folks think because of that's how the consumer world works. You know, your Fitbit tells the cloud, and the cloud tells you how many steps you walk. That's not the model you want for the industrial world. You want these devices to be autonomous, to be working together, and to be part of a community. The only way they can become part of a community is if there is some sort of a piece of code or silicon running across all of these particular devices. So you can imagine these various devices with what we call here a control point. And this control point basically is technology or a set of services that these devices have access to that allows them to discover each other, that allows them to discover each other's capabilities, that allows them to publish information, if you will, on a bus that tells the other devices what else is happening around them. It allows them to subscribe to information being pushed out by other devices. It allows them to understand the capabilities of each other through standard profiles that they might have. These are the kinds of services that these devices need in order for these devices to be part of a community, which means if you were a device developer and you were building a device or a family of devices for an industrial Internet of Things application, you would want to think about how do I get these services into each of the devices? And the way you would get it is you would either source certain kinds of libraries that are appropriate for the industrial Internet of Things. So this would be software stacks that you would basically place onto your devices. Or these might be chips that actually have the software capability already in there. Or they might be modules that you can source with this kind of software that you can build your application around. And then in addition to basically building devices that inherently know about each other, that know how to communicate, you are going to need pieces to put the networks together, so specific routers that are targeted for this industrial environment and commissioning and software tools, whether they happen to be running on premises or in the cloud, that can discover these networks, that can discover the appearance of new devices, that can create groups, that can do the bindings and so on. So these are the kinds of things that you would want to think about. So if you are an application developer or you are a device developer, and you're looking to build, you know, or transition your products from the old to the newer platform for the industrial Internet of Things, you might be tempted to think, hey, I'm just going to use one of these consumer-oriented IoT things that are out there. I'm going to use Zigbee. Yeah, that's right. That's my new technology. But that is going to be missing the point that the requirements for the industrial Internet of Things are different. And then the way you would look at actually putting a whole device community together is you would have to think about where the building blocks are coming from. You know, where is your software coming from? Where are your chips coming from? Where are the provisioning pieces of software coming from? So that you, as a device developer or application developer, can really focus on the value add rather than on the plumbing that is required for the industrial Internet of Things. And one platform that is available, you know, to these device and application developers is a platform called iZOT. And it really consists of a family of chips, of stacks, of development tools, compilers, routers, and commissioning software that would allow an application developer or a device developer to go ahead and actually construct an entire industrial Internet of Things environment of devices and applications and systems. So with that, I'd like to hand it back to Kurt. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much, Varun. Our next presenter is John Blevins. He's the Director of Product Marketing at LinuxWorks. He's responsible for the LinuxOS family of real-time operating systems. And prior to joining the marketing team, John was Director of Software Tools and Development for LinuxWorks. He has over 30 years of software development experience in the embedded industry, working primarily on software development tools, compilers, debuggers, IDEs, and related tools for a variety of companies, including LinuxWorks, Lynx Real-Time Systems, Anix, Telesoft, and Softtek Microsystems. John.
Thank you, Kurt. Well, my colleagues have done a great job at showing sort of what the Internet of Things is. To us, the Internet of Things, the definition that we kind of like best is it's the Internet of Everything. The basic concept is that almost any device that you can imagine that has not been connected in the past will eventually be connected to the Internet. This picture shows, for example, lots of examples you've probably already seen today, having your home connected to the Internet, your thermostat, possibly even your toaster or refrigerator. Your security cameras, all of the different areas, including the industrial that we just heard about, all want to be connected to the Internet, and they all are going to have a common problem, and that is security. Once all these devices are connected to the Internet, they're going to be subject to the same kind of attacks that are going on constantly today on desktops and phones and things of that nature. So what we believe at LinuxWorks is that we can help developers connect their devices to the Internet by providing more security in the RTOS. So today, as we've seen, much key industrial and commercial infrastructure is already being controlled by embedded devices, and these devices are changing. They're being connected to the Internet. They're using either long-haul networks like TCP/IP, IPv6 to get more addressing capabilities, cellular technologies, WiMAX, things of that nature. They're also going to be connected using short-haul networks, the Wi-Fi, the Zigbees, the Bluetooth that we've already heard about. So once all these are connected, they're going to be subject to any kind of traffic on that network, including malicious attacks from other things. Historically, these connected devices are coming from small proprietary purpose-built operating systems, and they're suddenly going to require both security and networking. Other connected devices have historically used things like Windows or embedded Windows, Linux, and Android, because they're easy solutions. You can pick up one of those OSs, put it in your device where soft real-time perhaps is the requirement, and get a good GUI or get good connection software. However, we believe that the vulnerabilities that are out there that attack Windows sort of systems on a daily basis are going to be a real problem for these types of devices. So how can we help solve those? Well, LinuxWorks provides real-time operating systems and secure hypervisors that we believe can be used to secure the communication and the access to these devices. So what we've seen is industrial automation, medical systems, power grids, the smart grid, all of these things are already connected to the Internet, and we've seen cyber attacks on these control systems. And what we see is that the facilities that for example, protect a power plant might be physically very secure, the software that is running inside those is not necessarily as equally secure, and that malware has become very sophisticated. So, for example, recent examples of a virus called the Stuxnet worm have been developed that were targeted against computers running in a power plant. So what are the various approaches to security that one can take? First, preventing infiltration. How can you keep the attackers out? Well, this clearly hasn't worked. If you look at examples like the recent Target department stores and the Neiman Marcus attacks, both what's happened is people have found a way to get into those systems and to actually get the data out. So, for example, customer credit cards and PIN numbers and whatnot have been extracted from that. So the idea of preventing people from getting in and preventing the data from getting out has not really worked very well so far. The idea of separating and compartmentalizing data to protect it is a very good one, and we'll explore that in depth as well. We believe that the answer is not one single layer of security. It's going to be what we call defense in depth, to have multiple layers of security to prevent the attack from trying to get in, to prevent the data from trying to get out, to compartmentalize things so that, that any breaches that do occur won't affect other parts of the system. So when one part of the security may be under attack and fail, the others will still succeed. So in this layered approach, LinuxWorks currently offers two different types of products. One is our Linksys family of real-time operating systems, and we believe that the military-grade security layers that we've put into it can help secure the OS and the applications from attack. And the second approach is a product we call Link Secure, which is a separation kernel and hypervisor, which can help provide virtualization support to run legacy operating systems and do separation between different functions of the system and different OSs. So looking at the Linksys family of RTOSs, we today offer two different products. One is our Linksys 178 product, which is a safety critical partitioning operating system. This is used typically in aviation, where if something were to fail or be attacked, you would have a loss of life, for example. So basically, in this operating system, it's a partitioned operating system. Each partition has its own resources, its own amount of memory allocation, I/O devices. The applications run in the partition, and they cannot see or interfere with any resources that the other partitions have. So this is a very safe operating system, and it's also very secure. It has a health monitor feature where if it detects anything is going wrong in the operating system, it can notify the appropriate applications and take appropriate action depending on what the application is. Our standard Linksys RTOS has military-grade security in it, and we'll take a deep dive into that. It's basically full symmetric multiprocessing support with a open standards POSIX real-time hard OS. So these are some of the features that we've put into the operating system to help application developers and embedded device developers maintain the security that they need. The first is discretionary access controls. Discretionary access controls are essentially access control lists that come from POSIX. They allow a user to assign properties to a file system object, such as a regular file, a directory, a device node, or a FIFO, and basically determine on a file-by-file basis who can have access to that file. So, for example, if there's a part of the system that should only be executed by, the audit facility, for example, then it would be protected so that no one else could even see or execute that particular process or file. Another concept I just mentioned is audit. And the audit facilities basically allow you to track what happens on the system and review security critical events that may happen. So, for example, if someone tries to bypass the security mechanism and break into the embedded device, you can track those attempts and the privileges of different users. and you can do forensic analysis when something does happen that shouldn't. The next feature is roles and capabilities, which basically provide a finer-grained privilege level for users over the traditional Unix model. The traditional Unix model has a concept of root privilege, and the root user can read, write, execute, you know, everything on the system. And then it has normal users, and normal users can only do certain things. So rather than have sort of an all-or-nothing type approach, roles and capabilities allow the user to have sort of a fine-grained set of things. So, for example, you could create a role that was allowed to do auditing and to review audit logs and to look at audit events, and no other users on the system could look at the audit other than the audit type role. Cryptography, we believe, is very important for these embedded devices. So any data that's actually collected on the device and sent upwards to one of the servers or to some kind of data collection place, that data could be encrypted and made such that if anybody is snooping the network, nobody can see that. So our Linksys comes with FIPS 140-2 certified crypto algorithms. We use OpenSSL, OpenSSH industry standards to provide that security. Identification, authentication, the concept of having the ability to determine that a user is who they say they are, and we use OpenPAM, which is the pluggable authentication module to implement that. It allows users to add, modify, and delete accounts, create roles, modify, delete them, groups, administration of passwords, password reuse tracking. You can't reuse your password, if it's been the same for a year, that kind of thing. So these types of security things for identification and authentication can ensure that for example, somebody trying to randomly log into a system will succeed no more often than one in every 10 to the 14th tries. So it's certainly a high level of security. Quota is important. Quotas definitely provide a way to make sure that a system doesn't run out of disk or memory or CPU. A lot of denial of service attacks, for example, a lot of these devices are probably going to be running on battery, and so if the system spends a lot of time dealing with an attack, a break-in, if you have a quota on how much CPU time that process that's trying to break in can have, you can limit that and prevent the system from running out of power and being shut down. So quotas, we feel, are a very important security feature. Self-test, essentially the concept of making sure that the system knows that it's in a good state and can remain healthy and determine when it's not healthy. Residual information protection is the idea of zeroing out memory once it's been freed so that programs can't come along afterwards and try and read some of the leftover memory and essentially find a vulnerability to break in that way. Trusted path. How do you know that a key, like for example, a keyboard logger type attack isn't happening? If you type something on the keyboard, how do you know that nobody's intercepting those keystrokes, like a password or whatnot? So Linksys has facilities to try and detect that. The other approach that we offer is our Link Secure Separation Kernel Hypervisor. And what it does is it allows you to run guest operating systems. You can run something like Linksys and RTOS on it. You can also run something like Windows or Android or Linux on top of it as well. And so it provides a virtual look at the hardware. You can assign physical devices to particular guests, and you can essentially use this to separate the devices in such a way that you know, if an attack happens on the Windows, for example, side, that the real-time OS also running on there won't be attacked. And here's a picture of how that would work. You basically got the hardware, the separation kernel, and the virtual guest running on top, each with their own protected devices in their own protected environment. Okay, so and lastly, just the summary slide. So by using a separation kernel, you can protect both legacy operating systems that haven't been secure in the past, as well as using a more secure operating system, RTOS, like we've provided with high-level security features, that the combination we believe will help the Internet of Things remain secure as we move forward. That's it. Thanks, Kurt.
Great. Thanks, John. We're on to the Q&A now. Again, we ask that you keep asking those questions remotely, and we'll try to get to as many of them as we can. Let's start with a question for Andrew. Andrew, we mentioned some RTOS zero configuration items. Can you talk a little bit about what specific features and capabilities might be needed in an RTOS to be able to enable zero configuration?
Sure. I mean, so some of the protocols that you would want to be able to handle is IP addressing is a big one as an example. So devices have to be able to broadcast their IP address and make sure there's no conflicts. If there are conflicts with other devices, they're going to have to be able to resort those conflicts with, again, without any network administration. What's more, there'll be services that other devices can provide. So when you insert a new device into a network, each device will have to negotiate with others to determine what services they provide, what services from other devices they can utilize. Additionally, you know, when it comes to zero configuration networking, you know, devices should be able to not only leverage, you know, what they're providing, but also, you know, work in a collaborative fashion so that, you know, they're able to leverage what the other devices are providing as well without, you know, any sort of intrusion or impediment. And then there's security issues that need to be negotiated as well. So those are the type of things.
Yeah, that sounds like it feeds into DDS and what Edwin was talking about. Edwin, in terms of these kinds of things, does DDS require some sort of device lookup server, or can I know DDS is based on a publish-subscribe model. Maybe you could just describe that a little bit.
Yeah, sure. That's a good question, actually. So the DDS standard itself does not necessarily require a device lookup server or any lookup server for that matter, but it does depend on the implementation. So our implementation of DDS, which is RTI Connect DDS, so our implementation is purely peer-to-peer. So basically it uses an auto-discovery protocol that enables devices to detect each other directly, so without the need for well-known servers or any central point of access. And the way it works is when a device first connects, it sends out an announcement message. And then already connected devices will receive that message, and that then initiates a protocol that actually sets up the connections based on the device's specific input and output needs. So there's the answer is that no, there's no need for a central device lookup server.
Okay, I see. Here's a question from a company that does building automation, industrial and lighting kinds of things. Varun, can you talk about what kinds of things they need to be looking for as they address the Internet of Things trend?
Okay. Today, the devices that are in building automation networks or lighting networks, by and large, tend to be on protocols and standards that were invented 10 to 20 years ago. So a lot of devices, you know, would connect to what are called field buses on protocols such as LawnWorks or BACnet, or in the case of lighting, DALI. And these are all tested and proven protocols, and the fact is those installations are not going to go away. So the key thing a building automation or a lighting control company should think about is how do they get the benefits of these modern IP-oriented technologies, you know, what we collectively call the Internet of Things or the Industrial Internet of Things, while continuing to maintain linkages or connectivity and backwards compatibility with, you know, the large installed bases of LawnWorks and BACnet and DALI and Modbus and so forth. So I think, you know, sort of getting the benefits of the new technology while maintaining the benefits of the past or interoperability with the past is the key thing. So what does that actually mean at a practical level? So if you're a building automation vendor, you would want to look at what goes into your devices that allows you to do so. Now, some of my colleagues have talked about the RTOS or the security or the middleware that allows you to connect devices. And these are the right kinds of concepts to think about. However, in the case of the building space, you want to basically also recognize that there are these older protocols that you want built in. So if you're a device company, Johnson Controls, for example, you might want to think about building a device based on these next generation of silicon products that are coming from companies like Echelon that are a system on a chip that allow you to essentially build a device once and have it be either a modern IP device or to behave like an old school LawnWorks or BACnet device or to be all at the same time. You know, and to do the kinds of things around publish and subscribe and auto discovery and self-configuration, but do it all in the context of the protocols that exist, like BACnet, LawnWorks, Modbus, DALI, and so on. So that's really what my advice to the building automation or lighting control folks would be, is look at those technologies that get you the benefits of the new world while still playing nicely with the old world.
Great. Here's another IoT application question. John, they're talking about medical devices and using their own operating system. They're looking at connecting to next-generation networks to transfer data to the server and things like that, so it's going to become a connected Internet of Things device. Can you talk to them a little bit about switching to a commercial RTOS and how hard, easy it is, what benefits there are, as opposed to doing that kind of implementation on the OS themselves?
Certainly. Traditionally, a lot of people use homebrew operating systems. When the devices weren't too complicated and they didn't have to worry about networking and security and things like that, it was much more economical to simply roll your own. And so that's actually very common. As you move forward into the Internet of Things, you've got to start worrying about, well, okay, now I've got to build a communication stack. Am I going to do a long-haul type thing, the TCP/IP? Do I need to learn how to implement TCP/IP? Can I pick up an open-source version? What are the pros and cons of that? Am I going to use wireless? Am I going to use Zigbee, Bluetooth, so forth? All these things are things that are going to allow your device to communicate, but they're not really going to differentiate your thing. If you do your own homebrew version of TCP/IP, that's not going to differentiate your product. You need to spend your time working on making your application and your device stand out and be better than the next guys. So by going to a commercial RTOS, you can essentially take advantage at a much more economical approach. All the features that would be in that RTOS, all the communication stacks, for example. So that'll get you up and running much more quickly, I believe. And then second, of course, is the security. Having all the built-in security that an RTOS or a virtualization approach can offer will certainly get you going in a much more secure fashion as well. You know, you look at Windows, for example, and there's probably a service pack each week on Windows where it's automatically your desktop is updating, taking all those security fixes. Well, an embedded device isn't going to be taking those security fixes each week. You've got to get that security in when you design it from the very beginning, and then RTOS can help with that.
Right. I'm going to try to combine some questions and kind of go around the horn with our speakers on this question. There's a couple questions that said the largest service on the Internet today is the web, of course. And there are technologies like WebSocket and that kind of stuff. Let's start with Andrew. And can you just talk about what kind of roles and services, things like WebSockets, HTTP, the web browser itself. How are these going to play with the Internet of Things or the industrial Internet of Things space? Andrew?
Well, I mean, not so much industrial, but just in general, I mean, you know, it's just that more efficient ways of communication. You're looking for, you know, solutions that offer a variety of transport vehicles. You know, when it comes to, like, socket communication, you have to look at firewalls and, you know, how do you navigate through them. And, you know, that's a play where WebSockets could actually come in. But in addition to that, you know, you start looking at encryption and security, the type of information that you're broadcasting or you're transporting, I should say. And then additionally, you know, Westphal architectures, you know, will come into play as well. So, I mean, those are the types of things that one considers when, you know, looking at, you know, at this, you know, at the type of middleware that's going to be required to interact with the web from an IoT perspective.
Andrew or Edwin, any opinion?
Yeah, sure. I mean, the web certainly plays a pretty big role in our lives today, and it is basically the interface for people to the internet, and the protocols, the standards like HTML, HTTP, WebSockets, all those are here to stay. And what we will see is that the Internet of Things will integrate with the current web, and the current web will continue to play the role that it has today, which is the interface to the people. So you will be able to interface with your devices using current web protocols and browsers. You will be able to look at the data generated by those devices using the current web protocols and web browsers. So the web is definitely here to stay, and it will integrate with the Internet of Things. And specifically for DDS, we're actually working on an extension of the DDS standard, which is called Web-Enabled DDS, which allows DDS data to bridge to web-based protocols like HTTP, so that that people can have easy access to the data and to the devices.
Varun, you talked about industrial of Internet Things. Will it play just as large a role there as the consumer IoT space?
In a way, yes, but so with qualifiers. The web protocols, and God bless, you know, Tim Berners-Lee here, are primarily client-server oriented protocols. You know, they are built around the use case of a particular device being, you know, queried or requested by some sort of a master. And that whole paradigm, the use case, is a client-server paradigm. In the industrial Internet of Things, you have a mixed use case of peer-to-peer communications along with client-server communications. And the web protocols as of today are generally not, don't have all of the extensions they need to enable peer-to-peer communities and peer-to-peer communications. And as a result, there are different aspects of the web set of standards that apply in different parts of the network. So, for example, within an individual device, you know, let's take a fan control unit that might be inside a building. So you have to ask yourself and say, okay, does that particular fan control unit, you know, which may have a microcontroller of some sort, need a full-blown web server in it? Does that microcontroller or does that fan control unit need a SOAP XML API? And chances are that you will conclude that in what is referred to as the field bus, which is sort of the last mile, if you will, of the industrial Internet of Things, you know, where all the devices hang out, right? So these billion things have to be connected to something, so that something is a field bus. Within that particular field bus, in the industrial world, we don't believe that client-server is necessarily the way to go. We think peer-to-peer communities of those devices on the field bus are the way to go. And so there will be extensions or there will be new technologies that a device developer has to think about. Just a regular web stack is not going to be enough to build the device they want around HTTP and a web server. Things like web servers also have a bigger footprint, as do full-blown real-time RTOSes and middleware and so forth. They're all great, but you got to recognize that these are $30, $50 devices that may have room for a $2 microcontroller and communication complex. So that's a constrained environment. So full-blown web interfaces are probably not the right choice for the device layer. Now, for a gateway, you know, something that's a supervisor for a collection of devices, somebody that's responsible for the connectivity to the cloud, there it absolutely makes sense to embed web servers. It makes sense to have REST APIs. And frankly, we are very big fans of REST APIs because then you can also take that local gateway and make it available in the cloud. You know, you can have a proxy gateway, if you will, in the cloud. And application developers, instead of trying to barrel through and connect to the premises to a router, can instead point their applications to the REST APIs in the cloud. So the web has a huge role to play in enabling the industrial Internet of Things. The trick here is to figure out which technologies make sense at what layer of the architecture.
Right. John, in terms of the WebSocket and web browsers and security issues, should we be wary about using these things, or can these be just as secure for, you know, the Internet of Things applications you've been talking about, or is it up to the end equipment?
Well, I certainly think that you should always be very mindful and worried about the security of your device. The existing protocols, I agree with all the other people, they're here, they're going to stay. A lot of them have vulnerabilities in them that have already been exploited. So you need to be aware of those and try and build a layered approach to security that if something gets through one layer, you can stop it at a subsequent layer.
Okay, great. Unfortunately, we've gone way over our time. Really appreciate those great questions, and unfortunately, we did not get to them all, but they are logged in our system, and feel free to contact the speakers directly, and I'm sure they will also be following up with the audience members that ask those. Thank you very much, Varun, John, Andrew, and Edwin, for helping us dissect the Internet of Things today. We at Open Systems Media and our presenters also want to thank you, the audience, for attending and contributing those great questions. This audio eCast will be posted online on the URL shown on your screen within 24 hours. An audio-only podcast will also be made available there. You can do a web search with the keywords embedded space e-cast and find all of Open Systems Media eCasts available for download as MP3s. Thank you for attending and have a great day.